This Two Lectures episode features reader, writer and blogger behind Brain Pickings, Maria Popova, recorded live at the global event in California, USA in 2014.
About 8 years ago, I found myself facing two parallel frustrations. I was growing increasingly disillusioned and disenchanted and disappointed with my experience of higher education, which seemed so focused on rote memorization and standardized testing, what Tara talked about, the sort of industrialized normalization of people. And it seemed so much more preoccupied with the accumulation of information rather than the cultivation of wisdom, which is really about understanding how different bits of information relate to one another to help us figure out how to live and what it means to live a meaningful life. And that's what I was really interested in, not how to get better at standardized testing. Now, while I was going through that kind of disappointing experience, I was paying my way through it, having come from Bulgaria to the United States for this sort of hyped Ivy League education and trying to keep up with America's 1%, having come from Bulgaria's 99%, which is, let's say, significantly below America's 99%. And I was working four jobs at a time to pay my way through this education. And one of them was at a little creative agency that consisted of seven guys, seven really smart, driven, idealistic, creative people, and me. But what I noticed over time, even though they were extraordinary sort of intellects and creative spirits, was that what they were circulating for inspiration around the agency, you know, those sort of office-wide emails of, check this out, isn't this cool? All of that came from within their own industry, so the communication arts and design and that sort of thing. And something about that felt off to me, this idea of how can we hope to create and to contribute to the world in new and meaningful ways if we only look to what's been done in our own field for inspiration. And so I took these two kind of challenges, the academic and the creative, and I decided to start a little Friday email newsletter that I would send to my seven friends at work. And every Friday I would share with them five things I had learned this week or that week that were really interesting and also felt important, things that I had learned outside the classroom on my own. And it could be anything from a groundbreaking piece of neuroscience to gorgeous Japanese woodcuts from the 12th century to Aristotle's views on happiness and government. And it came from this idea that I couldn't yet articulate, but I would later come to call combinatorial creativity, the notion that we create, we contribute to the world by taking existing pieces of knowledge, insight, information, inspiration, memories, influences, everything that we gather just by virtue of being alive and awake to the world, and fusing them together, usually unconsciously, into new combinations that we call our own ideas. I think of it a little bit as Legos. If we only have a finite number, like a small number of pieces that are uniform shape and size and color, we can build things, sure, but there's a limit to how imaginative and interesting they would be. But if we have this really vast array of bricks that are all kinds of shapes and sizes and colors, then we can make things that are really, really interesting and really unusual. And so the richer and more diverse our mental pool of resources, those Lego bricks of the mind, the more interesting our combinatorial ideas would be. And so in any case, I kept doing this little newsletter, which was in part a tool for that kind of combinatorial creativity at work, and in part a record of just my own learning and personal growth. And what I noticed over time was that my seven friends at work were forwarding those emails to friends of theirs that were in wildly different disciplines and walks of life. Their former college roommates, their girlfriends or boyfriends, their parents. And I felt maybe there was something there that was helpful to other people in their own journeys, even though it was just a record of my own, that there's something about this kind of cross-disciplinary, indiscriminate curiosity that appealed to people and cut across boundary lines of background or age or just occupation, anything. And I wanted to take this online. And so in addition to my academic course load and my four jobs, I took a night class and I learned some very basic web design and coding and supplemented that with a little bit that I was learning on my own by reading, watching tutorials online and whatnot. And the newsletter became a website. And I just kept writing about these ideas that came from art and science, psychology, philosophy, history, design, but mostly about how these ideas from different fields and sensibilities and eras relate to one another and enrich one another in that kind of relational way that helps us extract meaning from mere information. And at the time, I had no idea that the seven friends would one day become 7 million readers a month, and this once tiny newsletter would be a website that's included in the Library of Congress archive of culturally valuable materials, whatever that means. And also a sidebar question, what does it mean to archive a website in a library? I mean, that's kind of a very, very present concept. But in any case, I mostly had no idea that in the years to follow, this little labor of love would come to be my greatest source of joy and fulfillment, my life and my living, my sense of purpose, my center. And so today, Brain Pickings is just that. It's a record of my own becoming as a person, intellectually, creatively, spiritually, and all the things that I write about, whether it's the work of a philosopher who's been dead for thousands of years, or a really interesting discovery in astrophysics, in all of them I try to find some little piece that helps us answer, or helps me answer at least, directly or indirectly, that grand question of how to live and what it means to live a meaningful life and to live well. And so last fall, when Brain Pickings turned 7, it gave me reason for reflection, and I thought about the 7 most important things that I had learned in those years of reading, writing, and living. I wrote about them, and it wasn't because I wanted them to be some sort of preachy commandments for other people or kind of a blueprint to existence or the creative life or anything like that. It was mostly as these notes to myself, because those were the values that I kept coming back to unconsciously, and in hindsight, they just stood out at these sort of core principles. And I wrote about them too in the hope that perhaps in some small way they would serve as an invitation for other people to reflect on their own journeys and what it means for them to have a meaningful life and a good life and all of these things. And so I want to share these 7 ideas with you today. Number 1, allow yourself the uncomfortable luxury of changing your mind. And again, you and your means mostly me and mine, but really us and all of ours. I think we live in a culture where one of the greatest social disgraces is not to have an opinion. And so in order to avoid that embarrassment, we go around and we form our so-called opinions hastily by taking, you know, superficial impressions and borrowed bits of other people's opinions. And then we somehow integrate them and own them and go around asserting them really forcefully, because it's really scary not to know. And in fact, I'm the first person to admit it's so disorienting to just say, I don't know, I don't know. But I think at the end of the day, it's so much more rewarding to understand or to seek to understand than to feel right. And even if that means changing your mind about a topic, a subject, an idea, a person, and perhaps most uncomfortably about yourself. Number 2, do nothing out of guilt or for prestige or status or money or approval alone. Now, these extrinsic motivators, these are Seth's dancing monkey rewards, right? They can be very gratifying and vitalizing in the moment, whether it's a job promotion or a pat on the back from somebody you really care about and really respect. But at the end of the day, they're not the kinds of things that make it thrilling to get up in the morning and exciting and gratifying to go to bed at night. And in fact, they can sometimes distract from and detract from those deeper kinds of rewards. Number 3, be generous with your time and your resources and with giving credit, and most of all with your words. I think ours is also a culture where it's so much easier to be a critic than a celebrator, and anybody who does any kind of creative work and puts a piece of it online knows that people would do just awful and really not human things from behind the veneer of anonymity or just the distance of just the perceived virtual distance. But even offline, I think to understand and be understood, these are some of the most wonderful gifts that we can give each other. And we can choose, it's an active choice, to see every exchange as an opportunity to trade those gifts. Number 4, build pockets of stillness into your life. Meditate, go for walks, ride your bike nowhere in particular. There is a creative purpose to daydreaming, even to boredom. The best ideas often come to us when we stop trying to force them and we stop trying to sort of coax the muse into manifesting, and we just let those mental Lego bricks float and do their thing and click together. And that stereotype about why people's best ideas come to them in the shower, well, it's actually true, because the shower is this really completely unburdened space where you're not supposed to, you're not expected to produce, to create, to do anything but just be. And miraculously, that's when everything clicks. But perhaps most importantly, sleep. Be as disciplined about your sleep as you are about your work. Sleep affects every waking moment of our day, and it affects everything from how pleasant we are to be around, to how much energy we have, to how much the neurons are firing and making those sort of important mental associations. There's even research showing that REM sleep helps us sort of mitigate our negative moods, so it's implicated in depression and anxiety, and just so important. And at the same time, our society sort of encourages us to wear the ability to get by on little sleep as some sort of badge of honor of, oh, you know, I only slept 4 hours last night, look at me, how hard I work. And it's kind of, I mean, okay, but what it really bespeaks is not work ethic, it's a profound failure of priorities and self-respect, because, you know, what can possibly be more important than our physical and mental health, which both depend on sleep and from which everything else springs, including our capacity to give and to produce and to create? Number five, Maya Angelou famously said, when people tell you who they are, believe them. I think that's true, but at the same time, when people try to tell you who you are, don't believe them. We are the only custodians of our own integrity, and the assumptions made by those who don't take the time or care to get to know who we are and what we stand for in the world, those assumptions reveal a whole lot about the people making them and absolutely nothing about us. Number six, presence is far more intricate and rewarding in art than productivity. This is a culture that measures our worth by our efficiency, our earnings, our ability to produce this or that, or to accomplish such and such task. And the cult of productivity certainly has its place, this notion of showing up and work ethic. But at the same time, worshiping at its altar as religiously as we tend to, as a society, can rob us of the very capacity for joy and wonder that make life worth living. And lastly, expect anything worthwhile to take a long time. That is a quote from the wonderful Debbie Millman, who captures something so fundamental but so carelessly overlooked in our culture of immediacy and instant gratification. The myth of the overnight success is just that, it's a myth, as we saw in Elle's talk and these examples of, you know, Picasso and everybody else that she mentioned. And I think, you know, the flower, to use the garden metaphor, the flower doesn't go from bud to blossom in one sprightly burst, but we seem to be so disinterested in the tedium of the blossoming, and yet that's where all the magic happens, in the becoming of one's character and the making of one's destiny. And by the way, these wonderful sort of vintage children's book-inspired illustrations come from a poster that the guys at Holsti make. How many of you guys know Holsti and the Holsti Manifesto? Yeah, a fair amount. They're just these wonderful, earnest, small collective of designers and thinkers, and they make beautiful design ephemera that celebrate mindful living. And so last fall when I wrote about these things, they reached out and they were like, we'd love to make a poster of it. Can we make it? And I was like, sure. And so they did, and they have it on their site. But in any case, I want to go back to the last two of the seven, which are the ones that I keep coming back to again and again. In part, I think, because they seem at first glance as sort of opposites, these ideas of presence on the one hand and work ethic and doggedness and productivity on the other. But as is the case with most polarities in life, they turn out to be two sides of the same coin. And it's a coin that I think is our most valuable currency of creative life. Let's look at the last one first, this notion of doggedness and persistence being essential to success in any field, really. The practice of persistently showing up, or what we like to call work ethic. Now, these days, I spend most of my time reading, thinking about what I read, and then writing about it. And literally, it takes me probably 16 hours a day. All of my waking hours go to that. And in order to do it with a sense of purpose and without burning out, I need a rhythm that sustains me. And rhythm is something I actually think about a lot. Here's the great Mary Oliver. She wrote, "Rhythm is one of the most powerful pleasures, and when we feel a pleasurable rhythm, we hope it will continue. When it does, it grows sweeter. When it becomes reliable, we're in a kind of body heaven." These lovely hand-drawn illustrations, by the way, come from Wendy McNaughton, who's a good friend of mine, San Francisco-based illustrator, visual storyteller. Her work is amazing. Check her out. But in any case, Mary Oliver wrote this about poetry, but I believe it applies just as perceptively to life itself. These rhythms and routines, these reliable structures that make the overwhelming messiness of everyday life tolerable and manageable for us. Routine and rhythm are also an enormous part of creative work. They're the heart of this notion of work ethic, and there's something arguably as important as, if not more important than, talent, and certainly more reliable than what we call inspiration. Here's E.B. White, one of my favorite writers. He said, "A writer who waits for ideal conditions under which to work will die without putting a word to paper." He was a man of very regimented routine. And the painter Chuck Close famously scoffed, "Inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work." Now, this notion of showing up, it's incredibly important. As the great novelist Isabel Allende put it, "Show up, show up, show up, and after a while, the muse shows up too." I especially like the rhythmic repetition in Allende's words because it illustrates in a kind of meta way this notion of work ethic that, contrary to the myth of divine inspiration bestowed upon us in some flash of, you know, fictional genius, higher power, the simple, persistent practice of showing up is the thing upon which any significant body of work depends. Showing up day in and day out without fail is the most reliable way to achieve what we call lasting success. And once again, E.B. White was right when he wrote in Here Is New York, one of the most beautiful pieces of prose ever written. I highly recommend it if you haven't read it. He wrote, "Creation is in part merely the business of foregoing the great and small distractions." Now, he wrote that in 1949. It's especially poignant today when the great and small distractions are bombarding us from every side and, you know, any given moment. Now, that said, there's an enormously important flip side, a kind of caveat to all of this, which is this. The very notion of work ethic and its sort of sister cult of productivity bespeaks a very significant cultural bias that we have, which can blind us to the beauty and the vitality of life. In fact, work itself can be one of the greatest ways to distract ourselves from really living. And you know, E.B. White's great and small distractions, the small ones are kind of easy to identify. You know, all the stereotypes about, you know, looking on your phone all the time or being on Facebook and wasting time. These small things are easy, but the big ones, work can be one of the greatest of distractions from living, which is why my favorite of the seven learnings is this one. We tend to forget that being productive is often the surest way to lull ourselves into a kind of trance of passivity where we float and coast through our lives day after day after day, showing up but being absent. Even the term work ethic plays into this very toxic divide between work and life. I always feel very disheartened when I hear people talk about work-life balance. I mean, what does that really mean? Implicit to it is the assumption that it's okay to spend half of our lives enduring stuff that we loathe, that we dread, in order to make a living, so long as we spend the other 50% doing the kinds of things that make us feel alive. And I think that's a pretty depressing proposition. Annie Dillard, another wonderful writer and a kind of secular modern mystic, I would say, she said, "How we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives. And what emerges then is a different kind of rhythm, perhaps the most important rhythm of life, that delicate balance between productivity and presence. Our culture often encourages us to conceive of life as a series of tasks to be accomplished. You know, go to school, graduate, or if you come from this part of the country, drop out and start a million-dollar Silicon Valley startup. Have a family or create a major work of cultural contribution, amass some awards, a bunch of money. That's great, but so long as we look at it as a string of things to accomplish, I think it's easy to show up for these tasks, but to be absent from our own lives and to mistake the doing for the being. What would a be lectures be like? I think to show up with presence is a different kind of thing altogether, and it's a constant practice. It's not this static skill that we attain once and then we have it. You know, we're all set for life. How to master it's a very, very individual thing, and I think it takes a constant checking in with our gut, a constant fine-tuning and redialing. And for me, it has meant asking myself every morning if I'm excited to have the day that I've laid out ahead, and asking every night if I'm happy and fulfilled to have put the day behind me that just ended. And if the answer is no for too many days in a row, then it's time to, you know, get back to that inner radar and recheck and fine-tune and change something. Ultimately, I think it's about really asking ourselves a very simple but very powerful question about the rhythm of life, which is this. If how I spend today is how I spend the rest of my days, would I be happy? Would I be fulfilled and proud? Would I feel a sense of purpose? And at the very end, when my cosmic day is done and I look back, will it have been a good life? Will it have been a meaningful life? Thank you.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.